Hello, Hannah.
Yes, hello.
Yesterday we talked about the Democrats and their slim lead in the legislature. Of course, Republicans want to make sure they cannot pad that slim lead. And are the Republicans actually thinking they could get their majority back?
Absolutely. That's definitely the goal for them. And they it was described to me this upcoming election as a razor's edge election. So a lot at play here, but both sides definitely think that they can either maintain their control, grow their control, or Republicans think they can maybe get some control
back. So what's their priority here?
Chairman of the Washington State Republican Party, Caleb Heimlich, says their priorities are simple.
Our priority is to win one seat in the state Senate and or one seat in the state House so we can restore balance in Olympia. We're really just one seat away in the Senate and the House from a majority in one of those chambers. And right now, obviously, the Democrats control the governor's mansion, the Senate, and the House. And we think the voters are better served if there's a balance of perspective, a balance of voices.
The strategy, work hard to retain Republican incumbents and to flip one or two seats. In the Senate, Heimlich says there are really two Republican seats they're focused on defending in 2018.
Certainly, Mark Melosha down in Federal Way, he's a great candidate. He's worked really hard. And so that's one that we want to make sure that we're holding on to. Marty McClendon is running in Gig Harbor and Port Orchard, which is the 26th district that used to be held by Republican Jan Angel. So that's an important hold for us.
Now, if you remember from our talk with Democrats yesterday, both of these are seats that the Democrats are really focused on flipping, so you can expect these races to get interesting. As far as state Senate seats Republicans think they can flip, there's really one the focus is on.
We're looking up in the 44th district, which is in Snohomish County. Doug Rollstone is our candidate there, former Navy captain and small business owner, and he would represent that district really well. And so that's probably our best chance to pick up that seat and flip the state Senate.
Now, expect this one to get pretty heated as well. This is the seat held by Democrat Steve Hobbs for more than a decade, and one the Democrats are focused on holding, and they told me feeling pretty confident about. The Everett Herald says both sides have already spent tens of thousands on TV ads that started running this week. So that'll be a good one to keep your eye on. On the House side, Republicans are focused on holding seats in the 25th district in Puyallup, where a couple of Republicans have retired after this last session, and also getting Republican Paul Graves reelected in the 5th, that's in the Issaquah area, as well as getting a Republican in the 2nd seat in the 5th, which is open after Republican Jay Rodney opted not to run again. On offense, Heimlich says they feel like they have a chance to flip two or three seats in the House, including Christine Kilduff's in the 28th in Lakewood and John Lovick's seat up in the 44th in Snohomish County. And the 19th district in the Aberdeen-Longview area is a big focus.
That's a district that the president actually carried, and Representative Jim Walsh flipped that seat for the first time in 30 years. It had been held by Democrats for 30 years. They voted for a Republican in 2016. We want to obviously keep him there, and then we're going for that other seat to try and flip that and gain another seat in the state House. And that's an area where the Democratic Party has just kind of abandoned those blue-collar workers and moved further to the left and represented downtown Seattle. And that has given us an opportunity and an opening.
So those are all the races the Republicans are honing in on. And not surprisingly, they're all among the larger list of races Democrats told me that they're focused on. So again, expect some of these races to be pretty competitive and get pretty heated. As for the Republican strategy in these state races, expect to hear plenty of things like Democrats have gone too far to the left and having them in control will lead to Seattle-like policies statewide. And expect the now repealed Seattle head tax to play a big role in the Republican campaign ads.
The only reason those Democrats who had voted for it literally a few weeks prior flipped was because they had seen the polling. They saw how opposed to it people were. And so they came and repealed it and backtracked. But it doesn't change that that's what they were trying to do. And I think it just shows the priorities of the Democrat elected officials and what they're a left-wing base is pushing for does not match up with the voters of Washington State.
Now, their overall platform will also include warnings of Democrat control leading to a capital gains tax, which is a gateway to an income tax. And you can expect carbon tax, car tabs, and property taxes to also play a big role in all the Republican arsenal that they are using in these ads. But their overall message is that the need for balance in the state legislature, which Democrats will counter with arguments that when we did have that balance for several years, nothing got done. The sessions never finished on time.
Well, that is a pretty moderate message for any campaign, actually. We just want to bring some balance as opposed to these people are the spawn of hell.
Right. And again, Republicans, they didn't feel like the president, Trump, was going to be a big part of mm-hmm. this campaign. I find that hard to believe from both sides. But wait till the
final 2 weeks.
Right.
That's when you see the really, really extreme mess. But I mean, it strikes me as the partisanship, at least here in Washington State, has not been nearly as toxic as it is back in Washington, D.C.
No, absolutely not. But, you know, there's going to be voters in the state who are focused in on that, who feel like that and are just looking at it as partisan, which way they want to go. But there are a lot of big issues here. I know when the head tax, when we were going through all of that, there was a concern among people in the political arena that could absolutely backfire, not just for local races in Seattle, but absolutely on the Democrat-Republican stage in the state.
And just a reminder, the ballot should be on your kitchen table by now. Actually, it should be on your work desk so you can fill them out. And I say this every year, but it never helps. You are probably more powerful. You have more of a chance to have an influence in who gets to run for Congress, who will represent you in Congress in the primary, than you will in the general election.
Absolutely.
Because there are so many candidates, and many times just a few votes separates the people who make the top two from those who do not.
Absolutely. It's absolutely vital. You want to have a voice, especially in those congressional races, you have to take part in the primary.
And everybody who has ever said in the past, when you see your November ballot, geez, I wish I had a better choice. I don't like either of these two guys. This is it.
This is it.
This is the election where you get the choice.
Yeah.
If you can't find somebody you like here, then maybe you just don't believe in democracy anymore.
Yeah. Use those ballots.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I admit to being one of those who has said that, you know, if a company wants to use my personal profile, as sparse as I have kept it, to target an ad at me or even try to manipulate my vote, go right ahead. I can take care of myself. But Marshall Allen, who we talk to quite frequently, who writes for ProPublica, has explored the way that health insurance companies are using your personal profile. And Marshall, you're concerned about this. Tell me why.
Well, they're kind of taking the creepiness of personal privacy to a whole nother level. What the health insurance industry is doing is teaming up with data brokers to gather every personal piece of information they can find about hundreds of millions of Americans, and they're using it to try and predict how much we will cost for them to cover. And so this is non-medical information. This is information like the type of home you own, the type of neighborhood you live in, your income, how much debt you have, how current you are on paying your bills. All different types of information are being used. And what they're doing then is they're inferring, based on this non-medical information, how much we're going to cost for them to cover. If you're a woman who's recently changed your name, they would say that could mean that you recently got married, which means you might get pregnant, or perhaps you recently got divorced, which means you could be under a lot of stress. And both pregnancy or stress could lead to higher healthcare costs. And so, therefore, they would consider you a bigger healthcare risk.
But wait a minute, though. They're not going to then target you for a higher premium, are they?
What they would say is, oh, well, this information is helpful because it allows us to give better care to people who we know have greater need for certain care. We only use this to help people and provide better care. But what I found as I dug a little deeper is, you know, like LexisNexis is one of the data brokers, and they put out a press release that they're working with Milliman, which is the largest health actuarial firm in the world. And when they do actuarial work, what they're doing is they're analyzing the risk of the population that's going to be covered, and they're setting the price of premiums. So I called Milliman and I said, hey, are you using this personal information, these health risk scores, to help predict how much people will cost for the purpose of pricing their premiums? And they said, well, that's what we're exploring. I mean, that's what we're looking
really
into. We're trying to see if it's feasible to do that. Yeah. On the computer servers of the data brokers and the insurance companies for hundreds of millions of Americans. Like, I would just say your audience should just assume that this is happening with their personal information. And the inferences that they're making could be wrong. So you could say that, yeah, women who change their names are more likely to be pregnant or more likely to be divorced, and those could lead to health costs. But you know what? It's also very possible that a woman who changed her name is not going to have higher health care costs. And those assumptions about individuals might just be wrong.
Now, Marshall, you point out that one of these data companies, Optum, has filed a patent application to gather what people share on Facebook and on Twitter. and link this to the person's clinical and payment information. Have they pulled the trigger on that program? I mean, are they actually doing that, or they just filed the patent? And how would they use this?
Well, so they did file that patent application, and you know, they Optum is owned by United Healthcare, which is the largest health insurance company in the country. According to their marketing materials, they have data on 150 million Americans going back to 1993. They use things like your race, your education level, your income. They connect it to your claims to try and predict how much you might cost. And with their patent application, I did talk to the people at Optum. They said that that patent never did go anywhere, and so that wasn't something that they put into place. But then I also found Optum marketing materials where they talk about their ability to link social media interactions with your healthcare costs. So it's hard to know, and I think that's part of the problem. Some of the companies refused to even talk to me about it. And those I did talk to didn't even seem aware of what the federal laws said about what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. You know, the Affordable Care Act limited pricing individual plans based on this type of information. However, large groups, you could use this to price large groups, and you could also use it for things like, you know, President Trump has been pushing these short-term plans, which do allow pre-existing condition clauses that discriminate if people are sick. Those plans, you could definitely use this information for. And pricing isn't the only issue. I mean, there's other way the insurance industry discriminates. You know, they might design plans in ways that avoid certain types of sick people.
So on pre-existing conditions, officially that rule is still in effect, that you cannot discriminate against people based on a pre-existing health condition. But what you're saying is that you could get around that in subtle ways by using this kind of data to infer who might be the most expensive patients and then find ways to avoid covering them?
That's correct.
Marshall Allen of ProPublica, his piece is called Health Insurers Are Vacuuming Up Details About You, and It Could Raise Your Rates. Marshall, thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave. Have a great day.
Here he is. Bell bottoms, big hair. Ready for the Friday film review, Tom Tangney. The sequel to Mamma Mia, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. Now, remind me how much you loved the first Mamma Mia movie.
In fact, that's my opening line in my review, Dave. The first Mamma Mia movie was terrible. How could it not have been? It was based on the worst kind of musical, an entirely inorganic show written in ridiculously twisted and contorted fashion so as to justify including completely unrelated songs.
Yes, besides that, though.
The actors, to their credit, were game in that movie, but couldn't really sing. No. Pierce Brosnan, anyone? And the ABBA songs were, what can I say, ABBA songs. Like Cars for Kids commercials, they're the very definition of earworms, impossible to get out of your head. And now, a mere 10 years later, we have a follow-up movie, a Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. By the way, I take that phrase as a threat. And yes, it too is pretty terrible, but not nearly as terrible as the original.
That's good.
For one thing, the prequel-sequel design of the show works well. Since we found out in Mamma Mia that Meryl Streep's Donna had slept with three possible fathers of her daughter Sophie, this time around, we get to watch how young Donna met and matched with each of the three lovers. Simultaneously, the film follows, in present time, Sophie's efforts at opening a Hotel Belladonna in her mom's honor.
Belladonna?
Spoiler alert, we find out in the very first scene, so I don't think it's that big of a spoiler, that Donna had died the year before. The movie toggles back and forth between these two storylines, finding parallels along the way, one in particular that pays off nicely at the end. The key to this design success is the casting of Lily James as Meryl Streep's younger self. Best known for Downton Abbey and Cinderella, James not only brings a winning personality to the role, but she can actually sing.
I was cheated by you, and I think you know when. Look at me now, will I ever learn? I don't know how, but I suddenly lose control. There's a fire within my soul.
Come on now!
Just one look and I can hear a bell.
But even James can't save us. I know, Dave, you're all riled up.
But go ahead.
But even James can't save us from ABBA duds, like the film's first big number, When I Kiss the Teacher, especially when it's so poorly choreographed. Here's just a taste.
Everybody screamed, when I kissed the teacher, and they must have.
Okay, this raises something of a dilemma for this sequel. Since the first film used up most of ABBA's hits, a lot of the 19 musical numbers here are relatively unknown.
Yeah.
Who ever heard of Kisses of Fire?
Not me.
Andante, Andante,
nope.
The Day Before You Came?
Never.
The film senses this and tries to make up with it with two over-the-top productions of the two big hits that didn't make the first film's storyline. Waterloo and Fernando. The latter is getting the most buzz because it's done by Cher, who plays Donna's prima donna mother.
And I'm not ashamed to say the roar of guns and cannons almost made me cry.
Pretty good.
Now, I'll grant you, Cher's voice fits the song nicely, but the staging is so clumsy, she looks even older than her 72 years. The film also cheats a little by reprising the biggest hits from the first film. Not just Mamma Mia, but also, of course, Dancing Queen. Speaking of which, here are three nearly identical versions of Dancing Queen, despite the fact that one was recorded 42 years ago, another 10 years ago, and the other just this year.
The original,
right?
This is the first Mamma Mia. Okay, and this is. You see, you can't go wrong with those harmonies.
Now, Dave, I don't mind. By the way, that was the newest one, the middle one, and then the first one was the original.
Right.
Now, I don't mind a musical that takes old pop songs and revives them with a fresh new sound or interpretation or twist. Baz Luhrmann did that very thing in his excellent Moulin Rouge. But so many of the movie Mamma Mia songs are done so similarly to the original recordings as to seem redundant. But that's the point, I can hear ABBA fans screaming at me right now. We don't want them to sound different.
Yes.
Earworms forever!
Exactly. How many tangs?
I give it 2 out of 4.
Can you dance along with the credits at least?
Oh, absolutely, Dave. Okay. I mean, there's plenty of... I had many more clips I couldn't play because
Have
time. Yeah, that's okay. Enough's enough already.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. Did you see the New York Times piece about Nike's new sneakers?
I did. It was
the
folded
Vaporfly.
Out.
Vaporfly?
Yeah, it was left in front of me. I did a tour of Nike. It was when the Seahawks' new uniforms came out, so it was 2012. Nike is a remarkable company because I'm going through this massive sports industrial complex. It was Eisenhower that warned us about the military industrial complex.
But who warned us about this? Oh, it was Gerald Ford who warned us about the sports industrial complex.
Really?
Because he was a football player.
Oh, I thought I was going to warn you about it because I was here right now.
Oh, okay.
I thought I'd coined that little clever turn of phrase.
That's very good.
Leave it to Dave Ross to find a historical precedent.
Gerald Ford never did warn anybody about anything.
Now, here's the thing. I'm going through this tour with Nike and they're showing us all this equipment that they've developed and how they maximize it and all of this. And they make it sound like you feel like they're in a nonprofit industry for improving athletic performance.
Just do it.
Which I'm sure is part of the company's image, right? To be able to do that. And then you realize that, oh, this company is actually charging hundreds upon hundreds of dollars
for it. Well, but look at what they're giving you for it. This thing has carbon fiber superpowers. And did you see the survey they did? The study they did?
Yes.
New York Times did a study. And New York Times... No more trusted paper in the world.
It's not like the New York Post,
right?
Which was founded in 1801 by Alexander Hamilton.
Anyway, I mean, they raised their own issues with the study, but the point is they did find it makes you faster than
shoe. Like 5% faster, right?
Yeah, 3-4% faster if you wear the Vaporfly. And it's not just because fast runners already choose the Vaporfly. They found that overall. What is it made out of? It's a thick art. I couldn't find what it's made out of.
Well, that's probably proprietary.
Oh.
I can't imagine that Nike's going to give you the recipe for what they make.
Because that's what I want. And so the question is, would you pay $250 if you knew it made you 3-4% faster?
If yes. Yes, I would.
If you're a professional runner, but Joe Schmo?
No, me. Yes. I ran a 40.
You would?
Yes, at the sports media combine they did at the Seahawks. It was embarrassing how slow I was.
I'm not concerned about speed. I'm more concerned about my knees and ankles.
Well, that's because you haven't had your time in a 40-yard dash flashed up there in front of other people, and everybody said, my God, he's so slow.
I'd like to try it. Can I do that next year?
Well, if they do it again, I'll invite you, and you can be subjected, although you're probably faster than me.
Perhaps.
I ran it in a suit. As an attempt to try like disqualify or like to think like, oh, maybe he's that slow because he's in a suit. And I was like, no, man, I've been slow my whole life.
But here's
when
the
I was
issue.
Fat, when I was thin, maybe if I wore the carbon fly, I'd be fast.
Here's the issue. Since we now have a shoe which is documented to make people run faster, should that be part of the rules for any kind of competition that either everybody wears them or nobody wears them?
We're talking about shoe enhanced performance, SEDs.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Like maybe. Who knows? You don't want to give people advantages, but now are we going to regulate all of that? Sometimes in swimming, they regulate the types of trunks you can wear. There was a type of Speedo that was illegal for a little bit.
Well, I mean, it did make you go faster. It was designed with little micro somethings.
Yeah, but so does biology. I mean, I remember doing a study back in Spokane when we were talking about Bloomsday running, which is their big race. And it was like, why do the Kenyans always win? And it's found that they have more fast twitch muscles than slow twitch muscles. And that's why they're just biologically faster. So what are we just going to start, you know, putting people in categories of what your muscle makeup is?
Now you guys have dipped your toe into the great ethical questions of fair play in sports.
Yes.
You're exactly right. Like, how do you regulate that? The one thing about the shoe making you faster, that's actually a very small component of... Because I would think for a runner and for an elite level runner, not someone like me, who if I bought that shoe, it'd last me for 5 years because I don't run very much, which is why I'm slow, partly, although maybe it's my shoes. How does it keep you healthy? Like, how does it impact your body? Because that's a huge thing. And you can go to Super Jack and Jill, which is an awesome running shoe store. And they'll look at your gait and decide what type of shoe would be best to keep you healthy. Because I would say that a huge part, more than half, as opposed to the equipment and how fast you are in it, is how does it keep you healthy?
Mm-hmm.
Because
wear and tear,
subjecting you to injuries. Injury is the great bugaboo for athletic training, especially when it comes to running. As for the Kenyans, I thought it was Tusker that makes them faster. It's a Kenyan beer. I have a Kenyan beer shirt on.
It might be that too. We just studied muscle.
So this is not like corking the bat, juicing the ball, nudging the bases.
Depends on your perspective. Is it different than corking the bat? Now, corking the bat is against a stated rule.
Yeah.
But I've always thought that that's kind of in the... It's not quite PEDs because you're not taking something on your body, but you're cheating.
Yeah.
Is it cheating?
What, corking the bat?
Oh, I thought you meant wearing these shoes.
Yeah. Not yet, because there's not a stated rule. But if you wore something because you could afford it and get an advantage on someone
else,
is that
thing.
Cheating?
The cost.
Well, you're not breaking the rule, but, well, it is there. Oh, and there we get back to the sports industrial complex.
That's right.
That's really interesting. They've got a shoe that'll make you go faster, and it's $250.
The haves and have-nots of sports.
The NBA is going to come to Key Arena for an exhibition game. Is this a tease? What does it mean?
I was so mad when I first heard this 3 months ago. And then when I heard the announcement yesterday, I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. When I first heard that a preseason game was coming here, my reaction was, oh, you're going to throw us the little scraps from the table? Well, why don't you take your scrap and return it to sender and stick it up Adam Silver's nose? Now I'm like, well, this would be kind of cool. It would be the last thing that happens in Key Arena before they tear it down. Uh-huh. Kevin Durant, who's part of the Warriors, he'll be back here. They're playing the Kings.
Not tearing it down, they're enhancing it.
Oh, are they not going to... Wait. I was under the impression we were going to do some destruction.
We're renovating it.
The
roof line stays because that's a historic monument.
We're building an amphitheater.
Because Lord knows everyone in Queen Anne looks at it and says, our iconic roof of historic Key Arena.
They do.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do.
No one said that ever.
It's on the I-5 sign. It's a little picture of the Space Needle with the Key Arena next to it.
Yeah, well, it usually shows up in pictures.
But here's the other thing. It's not going to be called the Key Arena because they're going to sell the sponsorship to someone else.
What are they going
to
call it?
I don't know.
Oh.
What would you like
it's
to hear?
It's not going to be Oak View or anything like that?
No, they're probably going to make, if there's a dollar to be made in this city, like someone's going to figure out a way to make it.
I just hope it's a good one. You know, some stadiums are so silly sounding.
What, you mean the KFC Yum Arena in Louisville?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Sort of.
Yeah. What about if we called it the Taco Bell and then made the historic Key Arena roofline shaped like the bell?
Or you just hear constant ringing from it.
Yeah, I'd be okay with that. Oh. Taco Bell rules.
I love naming arenas after food.
Do you?
Just gets your appetite up.
Absolutely.
All right. So the bottom line is the exhibition game's okay with you.
Yeah, now it is.
Well, if it's okay with Danny, it should be okay with anybody.
That's right. I consider Danny sort of the exactly. temperature taker for what's safe NBA-wise in Seattle.
Lord help us all then.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Mr. Tusker.
Tusker, Tusker.
While we wait for the federal government to take some action on the high cost of your prescription drugs, wouldn't it be great if you could do something about it regardless of how long it takes the government to do something? Well, there is something you can do. It's a website called goodrx.com, and the main reason people don't use it, or more people don't use it, is that they don't believe it's true, according to Dr. David Belk, who for the last 10 years has tried to convince people that it is often possible to pay less than your copay for generic prescription drugs. He has a private practice in Northern California. We correspond occasionally. He has his own website called thetruecostofhealthcare.net, and I asked him, just give me a simple example of how this works. So we chose a pill that I'll bet a lot of you take. It's a common cholesterol medication.
So atorvastatin, generic Lipitor, and we'll do, you know, 20 milligram dose, which is an average dose, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, I'm just on goodrx.com. You can do 100 tablets just because that's a nice round number. And the price I get here at Ralph's is $17.90.
Mm-hmm.
At Safeway, it's $18.24. Mm-hmm. And at Costco, it's $19.92.
Okay.
Right? For 100 tablets. So we're talking, you know, 18 to 20 cents a pill is your price for that if you get their free coupon.
Okay.
But let's say you insist on brand name drugs because you don't like generics.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's do the brand name price. Same 100 tablets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 20 milligrams, $17.90 at Ralph's is the cheapest price.
Mm-hmm.
But the brand name Lipitor is $1,461.69 for these same 100 pills.
What? Who's going to pay that?
Well, this is the point. Okay. Brand name drugs, on average, don't cost 50 or 70% more than generics. They cost 100 times the price of generics on average.
But there's no difference at all?
Well, you get a little, you know, you get the little Pfizer symbol on it.
So why wouldn't everybody just forget about copays and just buy this stuff directly?
That has been my campaign for more than a decade. I have written blogs for Huffington Post about this. I have, you know, anyone who will listen, I say, do this. And, you know, patients come to my office and literally, that is almost the first question I ask. How much do you pay for this medication? And I just had exactly that. Somebody said 10 bucks a month, and I got them a whole year supply for $40. And I think there's a little bit of, you know, disbelief. Most people are just so taught that insurance companies are there to save money every way they can, and they're so taught that all these drugs are expensive. I mean, nobody believes it's true. This is your problem. You got that, you know, how could that be possible? All prescription drugs are expensive. This must be just a small part. Well, I have good insurance. My copay is only $5. It can't be cheaper than that. $20 for, a year's supply of a prescription drug is just one of those things that, you know, everyone's like, well, it must be too good to be true.
Well, I would suggest that the people who feel that way then just ask their doctor. I mean, couldn't you do that? After the doctor gives you the prescription for whatever it is, you turn to him just before you leave the office and you say, hey, I heard about this website called GoodRx. Do you have any problems with that? And he would say, no, that's a great idea. You'll save a pile of money.
I think I told you at one point, most doctors don't know how much they get paid for an office visit, right?
Right.
Okay. You're talking a really clueless business when it comes to prices and costs. I mean, it's just insane. Doctors are very focused on the medicine. They just don't understand this. I've spent a decade on this crusade, and, you know, I get so many blank stares. It's depressing.
Well, maybe there has to be a course added to the medical school curriculum.
I'd teach it if someone would invite me.
It's funny because I had heard of this site before, but I didn't realize that the discounts were like that. And I imagine this is why Amazon is jumping into the drug business, because they probably figure they can do what the law doesn't allow the federal government to do, which is to use their huge buying power to negotiate lower prices. But the bottom line here, and Belk has studied prices for a long time, and he tells me that even at 17 cents a pill, that represents a pretty good market. It's like 100% markup for over the actual cost of the pills for generics these days. And the idea that your copay may actually be more than you have to pay, than you would pay if you just paid the actual discount price on the pill, just is one of the crazy things about healthcare in this country, that it's great if there's a workaround. And according to Dr. Belk, there is. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The Trump administration has made no bones about the fact that they will probably try to chip away at the ease with which a woman can end a pregnancy. And the latest attempt appears to be as part of the rulemaking process under what is called Title 10. This is something that requires some education, so we've called up Janet Bronstein, who has written a paper about this. She is a health expert and professor emeritus in the School of Public Health at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Let's begin by describing what does Title 10 cover, Janet?
Title 10 refers to the section in the Public Health Service Act, which actually was put in place in 1970. And Title 10 gives grants to healthcare providers around the country to provide reproductive health services to low-income women. So this includes family planning services, cancer screenings for cervical and breast cancer, treatment of sexually transmitted infections, and referrals to primary care.
So what is changed under these rules that has you concerned?
Well, the rules do two things. They now tell providers in the Title 10 family planning system, if a woman comes in and she is pregnant, you don't have to do counseling with her. You can just say, well, you're pregnant, let us help you find a prenatal care provider. Mm-hmm. If she should say to them, well, I really have already decided I want to have an abortion, the rules are you can give her a list of prenatal care providers. It might be that some of those providers would also provide abortions, but you can't tell her which ones do. And you can't give her a list of abortion providers if they don't provide prenatal care.
Well, in your research, how many of these federally funded clinics, or at least federally assisted clinics, actually have physicians on board who would misdirect a patient or purposely not give her a list of referrals that includes a clinic that can perform an abortion?
You know, the trouble is that under these rules, they're going to have to do that or lose their funding.
I see.
So, you know, one piece of the new rules is actually, frankly, directing these providers to do something that, by most accounts, is unethical, which is to give women misleading information when they're asking for health information. The other thing that the rules do, which is really important, is that the rules say, if you are a provider of Title 10 family planning services, and if in another part of your clinic system you also provide abortions, you have to make those two services completely separate. Separate places, separate personnel, separate records, separate computers, separate doors, in and out, everything. Possibly even saying you as an organization can't do both things. And really that set of rules is directed to the Planned Parenthood clinics and other reproductive health clinics, which do both of those services, although separately. So the rules are designed in that way to push that chunk of providers out of the Title 10 system altogether.
Okay, so this is, I see. So that's what we're talking about. This is targeting Planned Parenthood.
It is, really. You know, that's what they've wanted to do for a long time. The anti-abortion interest groups have wanted to cut Planned Parenthood out of the Title 10 program, and this is their way to do it.
Okay, now the goal here, but let's look at this from the point of view of the people who are doing this. They want to reduce the number of abortions, correct? So will this do that?
I don't see how it does, because basically what you're doing is making family planning services harder to access for low-income women.
So you'll probably end up with more unwanted pregnancies.
I think you'll end up with more unwanted pregnancies and less safe abortion procedures for women who go looking for them.
If you zoom out a little bit and look at this issue down the road, is there a way, because we talked just last week or a week ago with a researcher who spent some time down in Central America that has prosecution and a ban on abortion, and yet the abortion rate is still higher than here in the U.S., which has some restrictions in place. You cannot stop women from seeking medical attention when they want family planning or an abortion. You just cannot. The research is showing that right now. So if you zoom out and look at this issue down the road, is there a compromise in the United States?
I really think there is. You know, I think nobody's saying yay about abortions. It's a sad and painful situation. We could seriously put women's health first, put family interests first, and have a good discussion about what does it take to prevent unwanted pregnancies? What does it take to help everybody be healthier at the point that they decide to have children? I mean, they do this in other countries. The conflict over abortion per se is legitimate. I mean, these are deeply held values on all sides. But the way it's been politicized and the way we can use women's health as hostages, really, in this political war that's jockeying for points is just tragic and bad for public health.
Janet Bronstein is professor emeritus in the School of Public Health at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and she's written an extensive paper on this if you want to really dive into it. It's called Radical Changes for Reproductive Health Care, Proposed Regulations for Title X. Dr. Bronstein, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.